Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later this hour, MSU President Luanna Simon here to help us navigate everything that was shared yesterday afternoon down at the MSU Center in Detroit involving the university's proposed initiative. It's, well, I'm not sure there's anything proposed about it. It is an initiative with Detroit Public TV. And alongside that, the decision not to involve WKAR-TV in this spring's federal spectrum auction. So we will try to learn an awful lot more about what all of that means and how it unfolded here later in the hour. If you have questions for President Simon or indeed for any of our guests, we want to hear from you. You can tweet us at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. Glad you're here today. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the world's fresh surface water. And the 8 states and 2 Canadian provinces that border the lakes are pretty protective of that water. Perhaps that's why an application from Waukesha, Wisconsin, to draw drinking water from Lake Michigan is generating controversy. The city says Lake Michigan is its only viable source for safe drinking water. But some environmentalists are urging the governors of the Great Lakes states to deny that request. To learn more, I talked with Director of Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes, John Allen. I first asked John why Waukesha is looking to Lake Michigan for water.
Mark, as we understand it, Waukesha is looking to make Lake Michigan to meet a court order that would move them off of groundwater that has a radium issue. Essentially, they have utilized groundwater. Groundwater has dropped. In that dropping of groundwater, there's now radium in their drinking water, or could be radium in their drinking water, and are looking for alternatives. Our understanding is that they've evaluated their alternatives, and moving to Lake Michigan is, from their belief, is their best alternative.
And how much water would be diverted to the city under their proposal?
I believe generally they're looking in the 10 million gallons per day range. I think there's some a little bit up and down averaging over time, but it's essentially a 10.1 million gallon a day average.
Now, the lakes provide drinking water to around 40 million people in the area. What makes Waukesha's request special?
Waukesha, both the city and the county, the county lies within something called a straddling county. So when the compact was originally negotiated, there was a provision in the compact that says if you were in a county that the Great Lakes line is half in and half out, then communities within that straddling county could apply for this exception. If you're out of the Great Lakes Basin and out of a straddling county, there's essentially a ban on the movements of water.
You referred to the compact. This is, of course, the Great Lakes Compact. Give our listeners just a little bit of background on the Great Lakes Compact. Why was it created?
Sure. The Great Lakes Compact was created for these and other specific kinds of issues. It was really meant to prevent the wholesale diversion of water out of the Great Lakes Basin to other parts of the country or the world. There was a proposal at one time to bring tanker ships into the Great Lakes, fill those ships up, and move those into foreign markets. The people of the Great Lakes Basin have been pretty adamant about maintaining water in the Great Lakes Basin, and this was a way for 8 Great Lakes states, 8 states and 2 provinces, to come to an agreement over the management of Great Lakes. Within that agreement was this condition for straddling communities, but by and large, the agreement was to prevent wholesale diversions of water out of the Great Lakes Basin.
Well, when a city like Waukesha, which is located outside the Great Lakes Basin, wants to request a water diversion, then talk to us about the process. What kind of process do they have to go through?
So Waukesha has been working on this probably pretty diligently, I would argue, for at least 5 or so years. The process is that the community, Waukesha, needed to apply to its home state, and that home state is Wisconsin. Wisconsin had to be convinced, based on that application, that Wisconsin believed that it met all the terms and conditions of the compact. Then the state applies to the compact council and the regional body. So the application doesn't specifically come from Waukesha. It comes from Waukesha to their state. If they agree that it's permittable or believe that it's permittable, then they apply to the compact council, which is what happened just this last week. The formal submission from the state of Wisconsin to the 7 other Great Lakes states and to the 2 other provinces of Ontario and Quebec for for their ultimate approval or not or disapproval. And then the last piece I'll mention is that there's really three choices that the Compact Council and the regional body will be able to rule on. One is it could approve it, it could deny it, or it could approve it with conditions.
John Allen is the director of the Office of the Great Lakes in Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality. We are talking about Waukesha, Wisconsin's request to draw drinking water from Lake Michigan. All eight of the governors from the Great Lakes states have to give their stamp of approval before Waukesha can tap Lake Michigan for water. What factors will the governors from these eight states be weighing when they consider Waukesha's application?
The compact lists some fairly specific criteria to evaluate against. One is, has Waukesha done enough conservation, for instance? Is there a conservation plan locally? Is there a return flow? Is that water that's taken from the basin coming back to the basin? And is it of good enough quality to return back to the basin? Are there alternatives? And what are the costs of the alternatives of supplying water in another way within that community? Can they treat the water? Can they get it from a different, you know, set of wells? Could they get it from, you know, someplace else outside the basin? So there will be a set of technical criteria against which that is evaluated on behalf of the states and the two provinces as well.
Who's going to be advising Governor Snyder on this?
It'll be a team of us, both through the Office of the Great Lakes here and the Quality of Life agencies, through the DEQ and DNR and ourselves, and obviously the governor's advisors. The state will be engaging in public outreach, public meetings, open comment period, in addition to tribal consultations. So we're going to do a substantial public outreach to make sure that we're hearing from the voice of the communities.
This decision is going to be happening against a backdrop of severe drought in the western United States, increasing demand for fresh water across the globe, and the threats that climate change might pose to water supplies. Do you think that is going to have an influence on the ultimate decision?
I think what will ultimately influence the decision predominantly is the compact, as it was written, and the agreement with Canada, with the two provinces. So it lays out the basis of what a good decision looks like. It sets the framework for that. And making sure that we understand that the compact itself, I think, was really negotiated with an eye towards things like drought and really good stewardship and management of Michigan's water. So I think that's within the framework that the compact lays out. The decision of Waukesha specifically will be really evaluated largely against the criteria laid out that the states and the provinces agreed to, that Congress ultimately ratified and the president signed. That forms the decisional basis for whether something could or could not go forward.
This is considered the first real test of the strength of the Great Lakes Compact, and some environmentalists in the region are worried that the decision to give Waukesha Lake Michigan water could set a precedent for other thirsty communities surrounding the basin. Are there other requests for Great Lakes water on the horizon?
There have been communities in the past that have talked about it, that have been interested, but nothing that we see currently on the horizon. I know of no other specific proposals that are being sort of diligently pursued or in front of the body. Remember that we're talking about a fairly small number of straddling counties, straddling communities, but the big issue, this notion of water leaving the basin, is precluded by the compact. So this doesn't open the door for water to the Midwest or water to California or water to somewhere else. This is a fairly narrow conception of what these communities that are sort of half in and half out of the Great Lakes Basin do, presuming that they return it all back to the Great Lakes Basin in a way that meets the standards of the basin.
Now, the DEQ has several upcoming opportunities for people to learn more about Waukesha's request and offer feedback. Can you tell us about those?
So we're holding two public comments or two public hearings, both on the same day, one in the afternoon and one in the evening. This is February 9th. At Lansing Community College here in Michigan. That'll be posted on the website for us. And you can get to there under www.michigan.gov/waterdiversion. Those details should be there. So we're going to do a first meeting from 1 to 3 and a second meeting from 6 to 8. Both of those will be live streamed, so people all through Michigan will be able to take a look, and then you can certainly go to that website and make comments. There's a comment card also, or you could submit emails. There's a lot of ways that public input can be taken on this.
John Allen is the director of Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes. We've been talking about the debate over whether or not to allow the town of Waukesha, Wisconsin, to draw its drinking water from Lake Michigan. The decision rests in the hands of the 8 governors of the Great Lakes states, including Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. John, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Coming up on the program, WKAR-TV will stay on the air in mid-Michigan. MSU President Luanna Simon disclosed that yesterday while announcing a new initiative with Detroit Public TV. We'll talk with President Simon about the factors that led to the decision to keep WKAR-TV and about what the new partnership with Detroit Public Television will involve. That's all coming up. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Most trivia events are for adults, with places like bars being a common setting for them. But in Delta Township, there's a trivia event that invites youth to join in on the fun. The Battle of the Books is an annual event at Delta Township District Library where teams compete against each other in a series of trivia battles about books. And joining us to tell us more about the Battle of the Books is the library's youth services librarian, Becky LaBeouf. Becky, welcome to Current State.
Great. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Explain to us how Battle of the Books works exactly. What goes on here?
Sure. Well, it's a really fun trivia competition that tests book knowledge. We have participants sign up in teams of 4 to 5, and we have a selected list of 5 books that they read over the winter months. And then in March, we have battles where they test their knowledge of those books head-to-head in a big competition.
And something's happening tonight here. You've got a battle happening tonight. Is that correct?
We have our kickoff tonight. Yeah, we have the start of the program tonight. This year, we're actually partnering with the Grand Ledge Area District Library, so we're trying to make it a really big community event. So we're having the kickoff there at the Grand Ledge's main branch in downtown Grand Ledge. It's at 6:30 tonight, and we're going to be giving an overview of the program, talking about this year's book list. We'll have refreshments. It's just a good time for people to get more information and to get their questions answered and to hopefully sign up.
How many battles are there altogether in over the course of a season?
Sure. Well, we have 2 different dates in March, March 3rd and March 12th, and each team is guaranteed to participate in 2 battles. And then we also have a final battle in the afternoon on March 12th, and we have the top teams make it to that final battle.
How long has the Battle of the Books been raging?
This is actually our 8th year doing it. We started talking about doing it when we were moving into our new library building. And so 2009 was the first year that we did it. And we've been doing it ever since. We've had a lot of wonderful luck with the Friends of the Library. They've been sponsoring it all these years. And like I said, it's been exciting for us this year partnering with Grand Ledge as well. But we've been enjoying doing it for all this time.
Mm. Are the teams usually all kids or all teens or all adults, or do you mix it up? How does that work out?
Yeah, we do mix it up. It's really a wide variety. It's open to kids in 4th grade and up, teens and adults, and we get teams that are all kids. We get all adult teams. We get a lot of families that do it together. We get teachers and students, grandparents and grandchildren. We've had book clubs participate in it before. And they all participate together in the same competition. So it's really an even playing field. We find that the kids and the adults are pretty evenly matched, and they all do it together. So it's a lot of fun.
So you're saying then that a team of kids might go up against a team of adults?
Definitely. Yep. And we've had all adult teams and all kid teams all, you know, make the finals before. And, you know, the kids have great memories. They remember all these details from the book. So they go up against each other. And it's really, like I said, it's really pretty evenly matched. So it's a lot of fun to see all ages combined
like
in that way.
Sounds like it could be the making, though, of some bruised adult egos here as well.
Definitely. It can. Yes.
We're speaking with Youth Services Librarian Becky LaBeouf about Delta Township Library's Battle of the Books, which kicks off tonight. I understand that now there's something different about this year's battle. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's our partnership this year with the Grand Lodge Library. They were interested in doing a battle, and we found that we have a lot of overlap between our two communities, so we decided to join up this year. And so they're co-sponsoring it, co-hosting it with us. We're having some of our events at the Delta Township Library, some events in Grand Ledge, and just hoping to make it even a bigger community event this year.
And now tell us about the books themselves. You've got these teams reading, did you say four or five books thereabouts?
Yeah, we have a five-book list each year. We try to pick books that are at a maybe fourth to sixth grade reading level so that the youngest participants can read them and that the content is appropriate for them. But also we're looking for books that really will appeal to the adult readers as well. We try and find a variety of genres. So this year we have some mystery, some history, fantasy, adventure, humor. We kind of have it all covered in the books that we have this year.
And what are some of the titles?
Sure. Well, we have Malcolm at Midnight by W.H. Beck. That one's a great one for the kids. It's about a secret society of pets in a school. We have another one called Under the Egg by Laura Marks Fitzgerald. That one is an art mystery, so I know a lot of adults will like that one. It has some history in it as well. We have a history or a fantasy novel called The Mark of the Dragonfly by Jaylee Johnson, and that one has a little bit of supernatural fantasy and even some steampunk in that one. We have one called Icefall by Matthew J. Kirby, which is about a royal family during sort of the time of the Vikings, and they're trapped for the winter while a war is raging outside, and they find a traitor in their midst. It has some Norse mythology as well in that one. And our last book is A Snicker of Magic by Natalie Lloyd, and that's just a really cozy sort of family, small-town story. It has a little bit of magic in it, a curse, and some good deeds in it as well. So there's a good variety there this year.
Finally, what are the teams competing for, Becky?
Sure. The top three teams this year will win gift cards to Barnes & Noble. And then we also have a smaller prize for all our participants. In the past, we've done bags and T-shirts and water bottles, things like that. So everyone who participates will get something.
We've been speaking with Delta Township Library's Youth Services Librarian Becky LaBeouf about their Battle of the Books event, which kicks off tonight and continues into March. Becky, have fun tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, typically being called a big mouth is an insult. But at the Wharton Center this Thursday, it's One Man's Exploration of History. We'll speak with Belgian performance artist Valentin Donens about his one-man, one-mouth show, which pulls from famous speeches across history to tell the story of the world we live in. That is coming up on Current State. That and more after the break. It is Tuesday and time for another Current State staff music pick. This one's from producer Katie Cook. Katie, what'd you pick?
I picked an LCD Sound System song. It's from their 2010 album, This Is Happening, and it's called Dance Yourself Clean.
And why did you choose this band?
Well, LCD Sound System is one of my favorite bands, and they broke up in 2011. But they just announced that they're getting back together, releasing an album, and touring in 2016.
You must be pretty happy about that.
Yes. And in just a few seconds, you'll hear why I like them so much. Many of their songs end in a dance party.
It's Dance Yourself Clean. The group is LCD Sound System. Thanks, Katie.
Sure, Mark.
State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Two of Michigan's most established public television stations will be more closely connected in the future. Michigan State University administrators announced yesterday that it will collaborate with Detroit's public television station WTVS to create programs that involves the university's work in its colleges of education, social science, and communication arts. MSU President Luanna Simon also used the occasion to announce that broadband spectrum used by WKAR-TV will not be a part of a federal auction this spring. The public's response to an auction was quite negative. The decision not to be involved means the station will continue broadcasting over the air. But President Simon said the Detroit project would mean a broader and more important role for WKAR-TV. And to learn more, we welcome back MSU President Luanna Simon.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you for being here today.
I'm delighted.
If you have a question for President Simon, you can also feel free to tweet us. We're at KAR Current State or email us, currentstate@wkar.org. Originally, people were expecting a decision today on whether or not WKAR-TV spectrum would be offered in the FCC auction. We got the answer yesterday, and that the answer made an awful lot of people happy, but the decision included details of this arrangement with WTVS Detroit, Detroit Public Television. People are trying to understand what the one has to do with the other. Are these two developments related, and if so, how?
Well, I think we'd use a number of factors to determine the value to the university of the spectrum and to the community. We weren't surprised that those who watched WKAR were supportive of the programming on WKAR. In fact, Downtown Abbey has become sort of a phenomena that's increased interest. I listened to the tape from the first public comment session, and it was pretty much what we expected. So it wasn't it was not really as a big a factor as people might have imagined in it, though we did listen to people very, very carefully. The station and WKAR were really established in the beginning to support a complementary community and university set of missions. That's when the university was the leader in instructional television, mm-hmm. and saw WKAR and those commitments as something that was extending its land-grant responsibilities to a broader audience. If you think about and to have it be a nationally recognized for its connection to the intellectual enterprise, because that's the value of a PBS station at a university, not a PBS station qua PBS station. And so as we thought about the experiences of our students, we thought about the sort of the way in which WKAR has evolved to be relatively insular from the university. The way in which we wanted to be more broadly national in our approach, not that the local things aren't important, but there it's an and, not an or, and how these leverage what we would do for the future if you were creating it all over again. That was the question. And so how do we develop partnerships? How do we think about the ways in which we leverage this asset on behalf of not simply a conduit for programs already developed, but for a broader community. And by serendipity, as it turns out, the Detroit station reached out to us because they're very interested in the future of multimedia, the way in which they believe that the capacity to access intellectual expertise is really the future of public television, in widely different ways, very different than the approach taken by WKAR.
But let's talk a little bit more about the process here. Did the negative response to the auction proposal create greater urgency for a plan that allowed WKAR-TV to keep its spectrum?
No, I think that it was a factor, but it wasn't the deciding factor for moving forward. We felt that with the opportunity to work with Detroit, we had to make a commitment early to do that. Their commitment is to remain on the air.
When did you decide not to participate in the FCC auction?
Really, there were intensive discussions when the public television in Detroit reached out to us, when Rich reached out to us.
And that was when, though?
Mid last week.
Okay.
Otherwise, we would have been in a silent period.
I mean, it's not lost on you. The process has added to a significant degree of suspicion here. The clearly negative response to the auction surged, but really quite recently, at 1 p.m. on a Monday, 6 hours before you had been scheduled to meet with hundreds of WKAR supporters. This plan involving Detroit Public TV, which I'm not sure anyone to speak of was aware of, this materializes. People are interpreting this, rightly or wrongly, as a desperate effort to avoid an unpleasant and pretty public encounter with a few hundred angry WKAR-TV supporters. What would you say to one of those people who is harboring those suspicions?
They're dead wrong. I mean, I didn't expect to hear anything differently on Monday night than we heard a week before or through the websites that we've been monitoring. It was always a question of how best to handle it. There were the proposal initially for channel sharing that would have eliminated the future for the digital app that was proposed by WKAR was just a wrong-headed proposal because it didn't give it solved the public problem, but not the issue of the growth of a future station that could be compatible with the mission of a world-class university. And so that set into motion a set of dialogue and discussion. It was always a close call, as I told you when we were interviewed before. Mm-hmm. There were lots of factors to consider, including what would be appropriate 20 years from now in terms of the way in which public television would evolve and how it would contribute to the overall mission of the university. Because I think there are ways of getting the content of public television available to the people who were complaining and through all of these sessions.
I'm curious how the last couple of days have unfolded, though, here. I'm under the impression you were originally scheduled to be out west, I believe, over this past weekend. Were you in Michigan putting this thing together?
I was on the phone. The provost did a great job, and we were on the phone constantly. Remember, there's a long set of discussions that have occurred with public television, mostly through Hi Fitzgerald's work with university outreach and engagement with the Detroit station over a long period of time and working on programs, some initial conversations and work on the sort of pre-KU that they've been working on, veterans, lots of things that were done really.
Those go back how long?
6-7 years.
Oh, okay.
So, and so there's a lot of conversation. So I think we made the decision in the way we did not to avoid the public comment, but because we couldn't comment after today.
Because of the
FCC requirements.
We're talking with MSU President Luanna Simon about the university's new initiative with Detroit Public TV and about the decision to keep WKAR-TV by not participating in a federal auction of its broadband spectrum. If you have questions for President Simon, we would like to hear them. Tweet us at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. What was the Board of Trustees involved in the Detroit initiative?
They were aware that it was occurring before the announcement.
Okay. They hold the license to...
And then they delegated that decision to me at the board meeting in December.
But they have they been closely involved in this initiative with Detroit Public Television as well?
They were made aware of that on Monday morning prior to the announcement.
Whoa. That's pretty recent to the announcement. That's not too far in advance of the announcement.
But again, the deadline for not being able to say anything, including for Detroit Public Television, once the auction process begins, there is no opportunity for public comment. So people who are interpreting, avoiding the discussion on Monday night, we couldn't have commented had we decided to stay in the auction, even if we were deciding not to sell the spectrum. There were no comments that were available after today. And so the capacity not to comment really drove a lot of the discussion and timing.
Talk to us a little bit more about the mission of WKAR TV. I mean, were you of the opinion that if WKAR were to keep its spectrum, then its mission had to change somehow?
There's more than one part of its mission. I mean, the conduit for public television programming will remain. That's gotten confused in this issue. There are other uses of the spectrum that can be used for multiple channels, multiple engagement, by splitting up the spectrum that doesn't affect the over-the-air capacity, that have to align with the community interest, the state interest, and the university interest, and the innovative interest of our faculty. And that piece has to be something that we look at going forward. It won't affect the people who were there on Monday night saying, I want to see Sesame Street or...
But did you view that as a fair exchange that, okay, WKAR-TV keeps its spectrum, but the mission has to change?
The mission always has to change to stay at cutting edge and to use the multimedia technologies that are going to be appropriate for the future in order to deal with public content that is typically now viewed as public television. You already see that in the cutting-edge stations around the country.
I take it there's a framework right now with Detroit Public TV. Are the details yet to be worked out? Are we talking about a framework with details to be added later, or how much has this taken off? I know there was a lot of talk yesterday of a 24-hour children's TV channel that may stem from this.
They already have funding for the development of that content. And the framing of that is around the 24/7 access to programming for children, particularly young children, which fits with some of the work that WKR has been doing, but it's also the work that the College of Education has been doing in Detroit, the Department of Family and Child Studies and the College of Social Science. They've already had conversations independently with Bill Strample, and because we have a health presence in Detroit, with Extension and the work that they're doing with kids and families. So this is about content provision, using access of funding already provided through Detroit Public Television. These are the kinds of innovations that are really important for a university to do. And that also then lets us think about, because we have information about how we can effectively use the spectrum for our own kinds of innovation. But it's not simply transmitting public television in the way in which people see it now. It won't hurt that. That can happen in addition to all of this stuff. It's not an or proposition, it's an and proposition.
Well, this ties directly to a question that we've received from someone over a listener here from over Twitter or via email. Will WKAR World and Create still broadcast? I guess several people want to know the answer to that. Is that clear?
Well, the channel spectrum will be used. How much of the content might change over time, because the content has been changing over time.
So spectrum used to broadcast World and Create might indeed be repurposed.
Or it can be combined in different kinds of ways.
Hmm. But
World and Create weren't the focus of the comments that we've had moving forward. And the question is what the content we're doing on World and Create can be used by Detroit Public Television.
Yeah, it would appear that WKAR-TV's existing programming seems to recommend it for this partnership. Curious Crew is a STEM-based program based on Michigan standards for school kids. All the other PBS stations in the state, I guess, are carrying it. Ironically, except for Detroit Public TV, it's been offered to them. And it sounds like now maybe they will begin to air this. And there are other programs being produced here, existing programs, that might accelerate this initiative. Well, are you of that view?
No, we looked at all of our assets. And the question is, how do you take those assets and position them for the future for meeting the public's need for access over the air to existing PBS programs? And how do you then position that for the future of what multimedia, a whole range of things are going to change pretty dramatically. When you look at the number of supporters for WKR, they're essentially flat. If you look at the dollars for WKR support, it's essentially flat. Hasn't kept up with inflation. So how do we leverage greater resources, both from, you know, people who are interested in this new kind of creative programming, and still also support the support people who are supporting existing programming? So it's a world of ands, not ors.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with MSU President Luanna Simon about the university's new initiative with Detroit Public TV and about the decision to keep WKAR-TV by not participating in the auction of its broadband. Do you expect, is there any way for you to harbor a guess? Do you know whether current staffing levels at WKAR-TV will be maintained, or would you expect cuts in this scenario?
We have to be able to use all of our assets, whether it's WKAR or a university department, to both meet current sort of obligations as well as to redeploy assets for the future. And so the question is how best we're going to do that. I think that's really premature. What we have to figure out and really imagine is not that we're bad, because everybody who's writing in is saying you're meeting a need for us. It's how we become really much better over the future and meet the challenges of a very difficult and changing media market. That's what we have to do, and have content that is simply not locally determined, but nationally recognized. Well, because people in Michigan deserve the best. And part of the best is having a national standard, not simply that local stations pick it up. That's not to say that Curious George and these programs aren't bad, but we have to sort of think about it as we have to bring the best of Michigan to the world and the best of the world to Michigan. And we have to have that standard and expectation for our staff. And like every part of the university, we have to do that in the most cost-effective manner possible.
We have a comment from a listener here that dovetails pretty well with what you just said. Cheryl Wade in Lansing comments, "I'm very thankful WKAR-TV will remain with us, but I have big concerns about regionalization. A TV station, well, she says radio station, but a station called WUGN, where I used to live in Midland, used to be a hometown station with hometown people calling in and lots of local events. Now they simulcast with stations in Georgia and Arizona. So we hear about conferences in Georgia, and the local announcers never talk about Midland anymore. I hate it. It's irrelevant."
Most of that, I think, reflects radio, which was going to be unchanged at any of the things that we're doing. If you think about the local announcers and the programming, the one exception to that might be Skubik.
Okay.
But if you think about the comments of people calling in, that really is very much a radio, and there was never any intention to change radio.
How might programming on WKAR-TV change? I mean, will some of these programs that will end up on WTVS, they will also air on WKAR-TV, or would you assume that?
Yes, because if you read the press release, it says that the programming will be available in both the Detroit area and the Lansing area. So it's really, if you're thinking about it from not a defensive posture, but something that provides more opportunity, that we're able to leverage the resources and the program development at Detroit Public Television to bring those programs to the Mid-Michigan area. And similarly, programs that are developed in the Mid-Michigan area can be leveraged in the Detroit market.
Will it be primarily WKAR-TV's responsibility to produce these programs? These programs will, to some extent, be tapping into university resources. Do you see the lead role in producing those programs with WKAR-TV or with WTVS? Or?
It will depend on the funding sources.
Okay. The idea of the round-the-clock children's channel was brought up several times yesterday. Is that with the Detroit audiences in mind, or
no, those,
more universal?
Those programs could be generally available. It requires, you know, it's the question of how we allocate our spectrum to include those programs, whether they're a part of the regular WKR programming or they're in a different part of the spectrum. Those things are yet to be determined. But we had to be able to say before, when we could talk about things, okay, which was as of today. And rather than going into a period of time where we were talking with Detroit Public Television and we went ahead and were in the auction, okay, and we couldn't talk for 3 months.
Understood.
Okay. That seemed to be not a good position for the university to be in, not a good position for the community to be in that sense of limbo with no conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So we made the decision that this partnership provided an additional incentive for the university to keep access to all of its spectrum, which gives us the capacity to do all the things digital and the new digital standards as a value added to this. And all of these sort of details about what's going to happen are going to be worked out in the framework of a partnership. And the first focus of that will be on taking what we're already doing and we're already committed to as a university and moving that to a much different level of programming and activity.
Thank you for your input today. We appreciate it a lot. We want to stay in touch and learn more about this initiative with Detroit Public Television that involves Michigan State. We want to thank MSU President Luanna Simon here for joining us today. Thanks again. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, the Wharton Center's Paysant Theater welcomes a guy with a big mouth this Friday night, and Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after speaking with the Belgian performer behind this show. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there, Mark. Yeah, the performer is a man named Valentin Donens, and Big Mouth is the name of the Friday show coming up to the Wharton Center. Valentin read over about 1,000 famous real-life speeches across history for this production, and he recites them, even sings a little bit as well for this one-man show. He uses a lot of comparing and contrasting to craft his message about history. For example, he takes two speeches from the end of World War II, the first by American war hero General George Patton, and the other from, well, the other side, and a propaganda minister.
It's really like I mixed them up, like some people use samples and put them in their own songs. I sampled from those two big speeches, the General Patton speech and the Goebbels speech, I sampled bits and I mixed them. So I'm really switching all the time. I do three sentences Goebbels, then I do three sentences Patton. Sometimes they say the contrary, but lots of times they just say exactly the same. One does it in German, and the other one does it in American. And they have a very different style, and that's very interesting. Like Goebbels uses these really long, beautifully, literally, almost theatrical sentences, and General Patton really speaks in these short, quite racist, aggressive sentences.
Yes. Good evening. If I just may have your attention for...
I've been fascinated with speeches for, I think, when I was 16 years old, about that age, just when I started noticing that some people were able to change the course of history just by saying words, not much more. And of course, they were at a certain point in history and people were attracted already to some ideas that they were pronouncing. But still, the power of just the words that really amazed me. And so I think it's my fascination with speeches started there. And I really wanted to make something more intuitively. So that's why I just started reading at least one speech a day for the course of a year. And I didn't spend, of course, all day reading this one speech. Sometimes would just write just before bed, just read one speech and put them on stacks in the hope that one day those speeches would start communicating with one another, what actually happened in the end. And that way I had lots of time just to think about it a little bit, don't make too much decisions too early, and the whole show is put together very intuitively, as if I was just guiding the speeches in the right direction. But of course, I did loads of work. I read too many speeches, and like only, I don't know, 25 speeches ended up in the show of the 1,000 speeches that I ended up reading.
do you feel like a responsibility to being true to the original intention of the speech? I mean, do you match the pitch and the intonation and the word stresses for those speeches that we have kind of an auditory history of?
No, actually not at all. In my opinion, every speech is manipulation is a big thing in speech, just trying to get your audience in your direction. So me, in return, I manipulate the speech again. So I'm wary when I do Osama bin Laden that I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm saying, but still I'm quoting Osama bin Laden. I'm not Osama bin Laden. And I didn't feel the urge, especially not with the ancient Greeks, to try and copy them. I couldn't as well. I don't have enough accent in my mind to do all those different accents. I can't do a perfect President Bush. So I always tried to make my own version and more have a hint to the original. Like, for instance, that's maybe the best example. I'm doing this Goebbels speech, which is quite famous. It's the Totale Krieg, the total war speech. And during this, I don't know, 45-minute speech, he's shouting all the time, "Wollt ihr den totalen Krieg?" It's like the cliche of what people, when they think of Nazi propaganda, that's how he did it. And then this whole sports palace is shouting back all the time, "Yah, yah." So I came up with this idea, why not try and do this speech a bit seductive, like I'm trying to seduce a woman, and do it very soft-spoken in contrast with him shouting all the time.
I lost my house. I lost all my cars. But hey, I still got my family.
The one-man show called Big Mouth was a big hit at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival back in 2012 and is coming to the Wharton Center's Paysant Theatre this Friday night. And we're speaking with that one man of Big Mouth, Valentin Donins, who took speeches from across the centuries, from Socrates to George W. Bush, and compiled this show. But as is often the case when looking at long-term history, the ones giving the speeches tended to be of one type, white men.
So the critic that I get a lot, I guess, especially in England, is that there are so less women in the speeches. I only do one-ish, and it's Ann Coulter. It's not like this, the most feminine person in the world. I mean the way she talks. But, of course, I'm a man, and as an actor, I would really love if some actress would stand up and come to me and ask to make a female version of the show, because I've still got tons of speeches lying, and I think there's really a female version possible. But I think someone else should do it, because if I'm going to do all these women, it's going to become a bit of stupid and funny. But I had in my long list, I had some Thatcher and Madeleine Albright, but they just didn't make the final list. That didn't have to do with the fact that their speeches wouldn't be that good, but more like for the dynamics in the show and the way it went, the puzzle didn't match with the female speeches. I have this big 50s-60s thing where I in the show, and I sing from West Side Story, "I Want to Live in America," and it's looped and it goes underneath all the speeches, and you get the assassination of JFK, of Robert Kennedy, and I Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. And I end this episode with Louis Farrakhan, a very long speech, because they're like a counterpoint for me, a new culture in America, but also the culture of television, and that influenced the way we write speeches enormously, because from the moment there was television, we had more this people needed quotes and like these one-liners. So they made all these speeches quicker and with shorter sentences. And so that's a big thing in the show.
For some of his performances of Big Mouth, coming to the Wharton Center's Paysant Theatre this Friday, the Belgian author-slash-performer Valentin Donins encountered a bit of a culture clash here in America.
When I did it in New York, and it was very successful there, but something I wasn't aware of is that when I'm doing speeches of Afro-Americans, some people find it difficult that me as a Caucasian actor, I quote people, Afro-American people. I never was aware of that. I think I'm from Belgium. People are less sensitive about that, me quoting Afro-American people. But some people, not a lot, of course, but you always hear the voices who shout out the loudest. They thought, that's our culture. Don't do it. Don't touch this. It's ours. So that's kind of that was a strange thing for me. But still, I didn't change it, and I'm still doing it, and I still can't really think of one reason why I shouldn't be able to quote people with Afro-American backgrounds.
Valentin Donnens and Big Mouth explores history through the speeches of others and comes to the Wharton Center's Payson Theater Friday night at 8 o'clock. Tickets and more information at whartoncenter.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our program for today. Glad you could join us. We want to thank April Van Buren, who directed our show today. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope to see you tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.